It's Dad! It's Dad! She rushed into the room. All the children were jumping up and down and fighting over the phone. Emily restrained herself for a couple of minutes, then took the phone away from them. Bill?
Hello, Emily.
Gee, you sound good. I didn't expect you to sound... Oh, Bill, you sound so good.
In Dallas, Merv began to take down a message from Perot in code. Take the... He was now so familiar with the code that he could transcribe as he went along. Code and... He was puzzled, because for the last 3 days, Perot had been giving him a hard time about the code. Perot did not have the patience to use it, and Stauffer had had to insist, saying, Ross, this is the way Simons wants it. Now that the danger was past, why had Perot suddenly started to use the code? Stick it where... Stauffer guessed what was coming and burst out laughing. Ron Davis called room service and ordered bacon and eggs for everyone. While they were eating, Dallas called again. It was Stauffer. He asked for Perot. Ross, we just got the Dallas Times-Herald. Was this to be another joke? Stauffer went on. The headline on the front page says, Perot man reportedly on way out. Overland exit route from Iran indicated. Perot felt his blood start to boil. I thought we were getting that story killed. Boy, Ross, we tried. The people who own or manage the paper just don't seem to be able to control the editor. Tom Luce came on the line, mad as hell. Ross, those bastards are willing to get the rescue team killed and destroy EDS and see you jailed just to be the first to print the story. We've explained the consequences to them, and it just doesn't matter. Boy, when this is over, we should sue them, no matter how long it takes or how much it costs. Maybe, said Perot. Be careful about picking a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel and paper by the ton. Now, what are the chances of this news reaching Tehran? We don't know. There are plenty of Iranians in Texas, and most of them will hear about this. It's still very hard to get a phone line to Tehran, but we've managed it a couple of times, so they could too. And if they do, then of course that guard finds out that Paul and Bill have slipped through his grasp. And he could decide to take alternative hostages, Perot said coldly. He was disgusted with the State Department for leaking the story, furious with the Dallas Times-Herald for printing it, and maddened that there was nothing he could do about it. And the clean team is still in Tehran, he said. The nightmare was not over yet.
Chapter 14. At midday on Friday, February 16th, Lou Goltz called Joe Poche and told him to bring the EDS people to the U.S. Embassy that afternoon at 5 o'clock. Ticketing and baggage check-in would be done at the embassy overnight, and they could leave on a Pan Am evacuation flight on Saturday morning. John Hull was nervous. He knew from Abel Hassan that Dadgar was still active. He did not know what had happened to the dirty team. If Dadgar were to find out that Paul and Bill had gone, or if he were simply to give up on them and take a couple more hostages, the clean team would be arrested. And where better to make the arrests than at the airport, where everyone had to identify himself by showing his passport? He wondered whether it was wise for them to take the first available flight. There would be a series of flights, according to Goltz. Maybe they should wait and see what happened to the first batch of evacuees, whether there was any kind of search for EDS personnel. At least then they would know in advance what the procedures were. But so would the Iranians. The advantage of taking the first flight was that everything would probably be confused, and the confusion might help Howell and the clean team slip out unnoticed. In the end, he decided the first flight was best, but he remained uneasy. Bob Young felt the same way. Although Young no longer worked for EDS in Iran, he was based in Kuwait. He had been here when the ministry contract was first negotiated. He had met Dadgar face to face, and his name might be on some list in Dadgar's files. Joe Poche also favored the first flight, although he did not say much about it. He did not say much at all. Howell found him uncommunicative. Rich and Kathy Gallagher were not sure they wanted to leave Iran. They told Poche quite firmly that, regardless of what Colonel Simons had said, Poche was not in charge of them, and they had the right to make their own decision. Poche agreed, but pointed out that if they decided to take their chances here with the Iranians, they should not rely on Perot sending another rescue team in for them if they got thrown in jail. In the end, the Gallaghers also decided to go on the first flight. That afternoon, they all went through their documents and destroyed everything that referred to Paul and Bill. Poche gave each of them $2,000, put $500 in his own pocket, and hid the rest of the money in his shoes, $10,000 in each. He was wearing shoes borrowed from Gaydon, a size too large, to accommodate the money. He also had in his pocket ₹1 million, which he planned to give to Lou Goltz for Abel Hassan, who would use the money to pay the remaining Iranian EDS employees their last wages. A few minutes before 5, they were saying goodbye to Goltz's houseman when the phone rang. O'Shea took the call. It was from Tom Walter. He said, "We have the people. Do you understand? We have the people." "I understand," O'Shea said. They all got into the car, Kathy carrying her poodle, Buffy. O'Shea drove. He did not tell the others about his cryptic message from Tom Walter. They parked in a side street near the embassy and left the car. It would stay there until somebody decided to steal it. There was no relief of tension for Hull as he walked into the embassy compound. There were at least 1,000 Americans milling about, but there were also scores of armed Revolutionary Guards. The embassy was supposed to be American soil, inviolate, but clearly the Iranian revolutionaries did not take any notice of such diplomatic niceties. The clean team was herded into a queue. They spent most of the night waiting in line. They queued to fill in forms, they queued to hand in their passports, and they queued for baggage checks. All the bags were put in a huge hall. Then the evacuees had to find their own bags and put the claim checks on. Then they queued to open their bags so the revolutionaries could search them. Every single piece was opened. Howe learned that there would be two planes, both Pan Am 747s. One would go to Frankfurt, the other to Athens. The evacuees were organized by company, but the EDS people were included with embassy personnel who were leaving. They would be on the Frankfurt flight. At 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, they were boarded on buses to go to the airport. It was a hell of a ride. Two or three armed revolutionaries got on each bus. As they drove out of the embassy gates, they saw a crowd of reporters and television crews. The Iranians had decided that the flight of the humiliated Americans would be a world television event. The bus bumped along the road to the airport. Close to Poche was a guard about 15 years old. He stood in the aisle, swaying with the motion of the bus, his finger on the trigger of his rifle. Poche noticed that the safety catch was off. If he stumbled. The streets were full of people and traffic. Everyone seemed to know that these buses contained Americans, and their hatred was palpable. They yelled and shook their fists. A truck pulled alongside, and the driver leaned out of his window and spat on the bus. The convoy was stopped several times. Different areas of the city seemed to be under the control of different revolutionary groups, and each group had to demonstrate its authority by stopping the buses and then giving them permission to proceed. It took 2 hours to drive the 6 miles to the airport. The scene there was chaotic. There were more television cameras and reporters, plus hundreds of armed men running around, some wearing scraps of uniform, some directing traffic, all of them in charge, all having a different opinion on where the buses should go. The Americans finally got inside the terminal at 9:30. Embassy personnel started distributing the passports they had collected during the night. Five were missing, those of Hull, Poche, Young, and the Gallaghers. After Paul and Bill had given their passports to the embassy for safekeeping back in November, the embassy had refused to return them without informing the police. Would they pull the same trick now? Suddenly, Poche came pushing through the crowd with five passports in his hand. "I found them on a shelf behind a counter," he said. "I guess they got put there by accident." Bob Young saw two Americans holding photographs and scanning the crowd. To his horror, they started to approach the EDS people. They walked up to Rich and Kathy Gallagher. Surely Dadgar would not take Kathy hostage. The people smiled and said they had some of the Gallagher's luggage. Young relaxed. Friends of the Gallagher's had salvaged some of the bags from the Hyatt and had asked these two Americans to bring them to the airport and try to give them to the Gallagher's. The people had agreed, but they did not know the Gallagher's, hence the photographs. It had been a false alarm, but if anything, it increased their anxiety. Joe Poche decided to see what he could find out. He went off and located a Pan Am ticket agent. "I work for EDS," Poche told the agent. "Are the Iranians looking for anyone?" "Yes, they're looking pretty hard for two people," said the agent. "Anybody else?" "No. And the stop list is several weeks old." "Thanks." Poche went back and told the others. The evacuees were starting to go from the check-in concourse through to the departure lounge. Poche said, "I suggest we split up. That way we won't look like a group, and if one or two of you get into trouble, the others may still get through. I'll be last, so if anyone has to stay behind, I'll stay too." Bob Young looked at his suitcase and saw that it bore a luggage tag saying, "William D. Gaylord." He suffered a moment of panic. If the Iranians saw that, they would think he was Bill and arrest him. He knew how it had happened. His own suitcases had been destroyed at the Hyatt by the revolutionaries who had shot up the rooms. However, one or two cases had been left more or less undamaged, and Young had borrowed one. This was it. He tore the luggage tag off and stuffed it into his pocket, intending to get rid of it at the first opportunity. They all went through the passengers-only gate. Next, they had to pay the airport tax. This amused Poche. The revolutionaries must have decided that airport tax was the one good thing the Shah introduced, he thought. The next queue was for passport control. Howell reached the desk at noon. The guard checked his exit documentation thoroughly and stamped it. Next, he looked at the picture in the passport, then looked hard at Howell's face. Finally, he checked the name in the passport against a list he had on his desk. Howell held his breath. The guard handed him his passport and waved him through. Joe Poche went through passport control last. The guard looked extra hard at him, comparing the face with the photograph, for Poche now had a red beard. But eventually he, too, was allowed through. The clean team was in a jovial mood in the departure lounge. It was all over, Howell thought, now that they had come through passport control. At 2 p.m, they began to pass through the gates. At this point, there was normally a security check. This time, as well as searching for weapons, the guards were confiscating maps, photographs of Tehran, and large sums of money. None of the clean team lost their money, however. The guards did not look in Poche's shoes. Outside the gates, some of the baggage was lined up on the tarmac. Passengers had to check whether any of theirs was there, and if so, to open it for searching before it was loaded onto the plane. None of the clean team's bags had been picked out for this special treatment. They boarded buses and were driven across the runway to where 2 747s were waiting. Once again, the television cameras were there. At the foot of the ladder, there was yet another passport check. Howell joined the queue of 500 people waiting to board the Frankfurt plane. He was less worried than he had been. Nobody was looking for him, it seemed. He got on the plane and found a seat. There were several armed revolutionaries on board, both in the passenger cabin and on the flight deck. The scene became confused as people who were supposed to go to Athens realized they were on the Frankfurt plane and vice versa. All the seats filled up, then the crew seats, and still there were people without seats. The captain turned on the public address system and asked for everyone's attention. The plane became quieter. "Would passengers Paul John and William Deming please identify themselves?" he said. Howell went cold. John was the middle name of Paul Chaperone. Deming was the middle name of Bill Gaylord. They were still searching for Paul and Bill. Clearly, it was not merely a question of names on a list at the airport. Dadgar was firmly in control here, and his people were relentlessly determined to find Paul and Bill. 10 minutes later, the captain came on the loudspeakers again. "Ladies and gentlemen, we still have not located Paul John or William Deming. We have been informed that we cannot take off until these two people have been located. If anyone on board knows their whereabouts, will you please let us know?" Will I hell, thought Howell. Bob Young suddenly remembered the luggage tag in his pocket marked William D. Gaylord. He went to the bathroom and threw it into the toilet. The revolutionaries came down the aisle again, asking for passports. They checked each one carefully, comparing the photograph with the face of the owner. John Howell took out a paperback book he had brought from the Dvoranchik place and tried to read it, in an effort to look unconcerned. It was Dubai, Robin Moore's thriller about intrigue in the Middle East. He could not concentrate on a paperback thriller. He was living a real one. Soon, he thought, Dadgar must realize that Paul and Bill are not on this plane. And what will he do then? He's so determined. Clever, too. What a perfect way to do a passport check. On the plane, when all the passengers are in their seats and no one can hide. But what will he do next? He'll come aboard this damn plane himself and walk down the aisle, looking at everyone. He won't know Rich or Kathy or Joe Poche, but he'll know Bob Young. And he'll know me, best of all.
In Dallas, T.J. Marquez got a call from Mark Ginsburg, the White House aide who had been trying to help with the problem of Paul and Bill. Ginsburg was in Washington, monitoring the situation in Tehran. He said, 5 of your people are on a plane, standing on the runway at Tehran Airport.
Good, said T.J.
It's not good. The Iranians are searching for Chaperone and Gaylord, and they won't let the plane take off until they find the guys.
Oh, hell.
There's no air traffic control over Iran, so the plane has to take off before nightfall. We aren't sure what's going to happen, but there's not much time left. Your people may be taken off the plane.
You can't let them do that.
I'll keep you in touch. T.J. hung up. After all that Paul and Bill and the dirty team had been through, would EDS now end up with more of its people in a Tehran jail? It did not bear thinking about. The time was 6:30 a.m. in Dallas, 4 p.m. in Tehran. They had 2 hours of daylight left. T.J. picked up the phone. Get me Perot.
Ladies and gentlemen, said the pilot, Paul John and William Deming have not been located. The man in charge on the ground will now do another passport check. The passengers groaned. Howell wondered, who was the man in charge on the ground? Dadgar? It might be one of Dadgar's staff. Some of them knew Howell, some did not. He peered along the aisle. Someone came aboard. Howell stared. It was a man in a Pan Am uniform. Howell relaxed. The man went slowly down the plane, checking each of 500 passports, doing a face-to-picture identification, then examining the photographs and seals to see whether they had been tampered with. "Ladies and gentlemen, Captain speaking again. They have decided to check the baggage as it is loaded. If you hear your claim check number called, would you please identify yourself?" Kathy had all the claim checks in her handbag. As the first numbers were called, Howell saw her sorting through the checks. He tried to attract her attention, to signal her not to identify herself. It might be a trick. More numbers were called, but nobody got up. Howell guessed everyone had decided they would rather lose their luggage than risk getting off this plane. "Ladies and gentlemen, please identify yourself when these numbers are called. You will not have to get off the plane. Just hand over your key so the bags can be opened for searching." Howell was not reassured. He watched Kathy, still trying to catch her eye. More numbers were called, but she did not get up. "Ladies and gentlemen, some good news. We have checked with Pan Am's European headquarters and have been given permission to take off with an overload of passengers." There was a ragged cheer. Howell looked over at Joe Poche. Poche had his passport on his chest, and he was sitting back with his eyes closed, apparently asleep. Joe must have ice in his veins, Howell thought. There was sure to be a lot of pressure on Dad Gar as the sun went down. It had to be obvious that Paul and Bill were not on the plane. If 1,000 people were deplaned and escorted back to the embassy, the revolutionary authorities would have to go through the whole rigmarole again tomorrow, and somebody up there was bound to say, "No way" to that. Howell knew that he and the rest of the clean team were certainly guilty of crimes now. They had connived at the escape of Paul and Bill, and whether the Iranians called that conspiracy or being an accessory after the fact or some other name, it had to be against the law. He went over in his mind the story they had all agreed to tell if they were arrested. They had left the Hyatt on Monday morning, they would say, and had gone to Keen Taylor's house. Howell had wanted to tell the truth and say the Dvoranchik place, but the others had pointed out that this might bring down trouble on the head of Dvoranchik's landlady, whereas Taylor's landlord did not live on the premises. They had spent Monday and Tuesday at Taylor's, then had gone to Lou Goltz's house on Tuesday afternoon. From then on, they would tell the truth. The story would not protect the clean team. Howell knew all too well that Dadgar did not care whether his hostages were guilty or innocent. At 6 o'clock, the captain said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have permission to take off." The doors were slammed and the plane was moving within seconds. The passengers without seats were told by stewardesses to sit on the floor. As they taxied, Howell thought, "Surely we wouldn't stop now, even if we were ordered to." The 747 gathered speed along the runway and took off. They were still in Iranian airspace. The Iranians could send up fighter jets. A little later, the captain said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have now departed Iranian airspace." The passengers gave a weary cheer. "We made it," Howell thought. He picked up his paperback thriller. Joe Poche left his seat and went to find the chief steward. "Is there any way the pilot could get a message through to the States?" he asked. "I don't know," the steward said. "Write your message and I'll ask him." Poche returned to his seat and got out paper and a pen. He wrote, "To Merv Stouffer, 7171 Forest Lane, Dallas, Texas." He thought for a minute about what his message should be. He recalled EDS's recruiting motto. "Eagles don't flock. You have to find them one at a time." He wrote, "The eagles have flown their nest."
Ross Perot wanted to meet up with the clean team before returning to the States. He was keen to get everyone together so that he could see and touch them all and be absolutely sure they were safe and well. However, on Friday in Istanbul, he could not confirm the destination of the evacuation flight that would bring the clean team out of Tehran. John Curlin, the laid-back pilot of the leased Boeing 707, had the answer to that problem. "Those evacuation planes must fly up over Istanbul," he said. "We'll just sit on the runway until they pass overhead, then call them on the radio and ask them." In the end, that was not necessary. Stouffer called on Saturday morning and told Perot the clean team would be on the Frankfurt plane. Perot and the others checked out of the Sheraton at midday and went to the airport to join Boulware and Simons on the plane. They took off late in the afternoon. When they were in the air, Perot called Dallas. With the plane's single sideband radio, it was as easy as calling from New York. He reached Merv Stouffer. "What's happening with the clean team?" Perot asked. "I got a message," said Stouffer. "It came from the European headquarters of Pan Am. It just says, 'The eagles have flown their nest.'" Perot smiled. "All safe." Perot left the flight deck and returned to the passenger cabin. His heroes looked washed out. At Istanbul Airport, he had sent Taylor into the duty-free shop to buy cigarettes, snacks, and liquor, and Taylor had spent over $1,000. They all had a drink to celebrate the escape of the clean team, but nobody was in the mood, and 10 minutes later they were all sitting around on the plush upholstery with their glasses still full. Someone started a poker game, but it petered out. The crew of the 707 included two pretty stewardesses. Perrault got them to put their arms around Taylor, then took a photograph. He threatened to show the photo to Taylor's wife, Mary, if Taylor ever gave him a hard time. Most of them were too tired to sleep, but Gayden went back to the luxurious bedroom and lay down on the king-size bed. Perrault was a little miffed. He thought Simons, who was older and looked completely drained, should have had the bed. But Simons was talking to one of the stewardesses, Anita Melton. She was a vivacious blonde Swedish girl in her 20s, with a zany sense of humor, a wild imagination, and a penchant for the outlandish. She was fun. Simons recognized a kindred soul, someone who did not care too much about what other people thought, an individual. He liked her. He realized that it was the first time since the death of Lucille that he had felt attracted to a woman. He really had come back to life. Ron Davis began to feel sleepy. The king-size bed was big enough for two, he thought. So he went into the bedroom and lay down beside Gayden. Gayden opened his eyes.
Davis, he said incredulously, what the hell are you doing in bed with me? Don't sweat it, said Davis. Now you can tell all your friends you slept with a nigger.
He closed his eyes. As the plane approached Frankfurt, Simons recalled that he was still responsible for Paul and Bill, and his mind went back to work, extrapolating possibilities for enemy action. He asked Perrault, does Germany have an extradition treaty with Iran?
I don't know, said Perrault.
He got the Simons look.
I'll find out, he added.
He called Dallas and asked for Tom Luce, the lawyer. Tom, does Germany have an extradition treaty with Iran?
Luce said, I'm 99% sure they do not,
Perrault told Simons. Simons said, I've seen men killed because they were 99% sure they were safe. Perrault said to Luce, let's get 100% sure. I'll call you again in a few minutes. They landed at Frankfurt and checked into a hotel within the airport complex. The German desk clerk seemed curious and carefully noted all their passport numbers. This increased Simons' unease. They gathered in Perrault's room, and Perrault called Dallas again. This time he spoke to T.J. Marquez. T.J. said, I called an international lawyer in Washington, and he thinks there is an extradition treaty between Iran and Germany. Also, he said the Germans are kind of legalistic about stuff like this, and if they got a request to pick up Paul and Bill, hell, they'd probably go right ahead and do it. Perrault repeated all of that to Simons. Okay, said Simons, we're not going to take any chances at this point in the game. There's a movie house with three screens down at the basement level in this airport. Paul and Bill can hide in them. Where's Bill?
Going to buy toothpaste, someone said.
Jay, go find him. Coburn went out. Simons said, Paul goes into one theater with Jay. Bill goes into another with Keen. Pat Scully stands guard outside. He has a ticket so he can go in and check on the others. It was interesting, Perrault thought, to see the switches turn and the wheels start rolling as Simons changed from an old man relaxing on a plane to a commando leader again. Simons said, the entrance to the train station is down in the basement near the movies. If there's any sign of trouble, Scully gets the four men out of the movies and they all take a subway downtown. They rent a car and drive to England. If nothing happens, we get them out of the movies when we're about to board the plane. All right, let's do it. Bill was down at the shopping precinct. He had changed some money and bought toothpaste, a toothbrush, and a comb. He decided that a fresh new shirt would make him feel human again, so he went to change some more money. He was standing in line at the currency exchange booth when Coburn tapped him on the shoulder.
Ross wants to see you in the hotel, Coburn said.
What for?
I can't talk about it now. You need to come on back.
You've got to be kidding.
Let's go.
They went to Perrault's room, and Perrault explained to Bill what was happening. Bill could hardly believe it. He had thought for sure he was safe in modern, civilized Germany. Would he ever be safe, he wondered. Would that guard pursue him to the ends of the earth, never resting until Bill was returned to Iran or killed? Coburn did not know whether there was any real chance of Paul and Bill getting into trouble here in Frankfurt, but he did know the value of Simons' elaborate precautions. Much of what Simons had planned over the past 7 weeks had come to nothing. The attack on the first jail, the idea of snatching Paul and Bill from house arrest, the route out via Kuwait. But then some of the contingencies for which Simons planned had come to pass, often the most far-fetched ones. The Gazer prison had been stormed, and Rashid was there. The road to Cerro, which Simons and Coburn had carefully reconnoitered, had in the end been their route out. Even making Paul and Bill learn all the information on their false passports had turned out to be crucial when the man in the long black overcoat started asking questions. Coburn needed no convincing. Whatever Simons said was okay with him. They went down to the movie house. There were three films. Two were porno movies, and the third was Jaws 2. Bill and Taylor got Jaws 2. Paul and Coburn went in to see something about naked South Sea maidens. Paul sat staring at the screen, bored and tired. The movie was in German, not that the dialogue appeared to count for much.
What could be worse, he thought, than a bad X-rated movie? Suddenly, he heard a loud snort. He looked at Coburn. Coburn was fast asleep, snoring.
When John Howell and the rest of the clean team landed at Frankfurt, Simons had everything set up for a quick turnaround. Ron Davis was at the arrival gate, waiting to pull the clean team out of the line and direct them to another gate where the Boeing 707 was parked. Ralph Boulware was watching from a distance. As soon as he saw the first member of the clean team arrive, he would go down to the movie theater and tell Scully to round up the guys inside. Jim Schwaback was in the roped-off press area where reporters were waiting to see the American evacuees. He was sitting next to writer Pierre Salinger, who did not know how close he was to a really good story, and pretending to read a furniture advertisement in a German newspaper. Schwaback's job was to tail the clean team from one gate to the other, just to make sure no one was following them. If there was trouble, Schwaback and Davis would start a disturbance. It would not matter much if they were arrested by the Germans, for there was no reason for them to be extradited to Iran. The plan went like clockwork. There was only one hitch. Rich and Kathy Gallagher did not want to go to Dallas. They had no friends or family there. They were not sure what their future would be. They did not know whether the dog Buffy would be allowed to enter the USA, and they did not want to get on another plane. They said goodbye and went off to make their own arrangements. The rest of the clean team, John Howell, Bob Young, and Joe Poche, followed Ron Davis and boarded the Boeing 707. Jim Schwaback tailed them. Ralph Boulware rounded up everyone else, and they all got on board for the flight home. Merv Stoffer, in Dallas, had called Frankfurt Airport and ordered food for the flight. He had asked for 30 super deluxe meals, each including fish, fowl, and beef, 6 seafood trays with sauce, horseradish, and lemon, 6 hors d'oeuvre trays, 6 sandwich trays with ham and cheese, roast beef, turkey, and Swiss cheese, 6 dip trays with raw vegetables and blue cheese and vinaigrette dip, 3 cheese trays with assorted breads and crackers, 4 deluxe pastry trays, 4 fresh fruit trays, 4 bottles of brandy, 20 7-ups and 20 ginger ales, 10 club sodas and 10 tonics, 10 quarts of orange juice, 50 cartons of milk, 4 gallons of freshly brewed coffee and thermos bottles, 100 sets of plastic cutlery consisting of knife, fork, and spoon, 6 dozen paper plates in 2 sizes, 6 dozen plastic glasses, 6 dozen styrofoam cups, 2 cartons each of Kent, Marlboro, Kool, and Salem Light cigarettes, and 2 boxes of chocolates. There had been a mix-up, and the airport caterers had delivered the order double. Takeoff was delayed. An ice storm had dropped out of nowhere, and the Boeing 707 was last in the queue for de-icing. Commercial flights had priority. Bill began to worry. The airport was going to close at midnight, and they might have to get off the plane and return to the hotel. Bill did not want to spend the night in Germany. He wanted American soil beneath his feet. John Howell, Joe Poche, and Bob Young told the story of their flight from Tehran. Both Paul and Bill were chilled to hear how implacably determined Dadgar had been to prevent their leaving the country. At last, the plane was de-iced. But then its number one engine would not start. Pilot John Carlin traced the problem to the start valve. Engineer Ken Lentz got off the plane and held the valve open manually while Carlin started the engine. Perot brought Rashid to the flight deck. Rashid had never flown until yesterday, and he wanted to sit with the crew. Perot said to Carlin, "Let's have a really spectacular takeoff." "You got it," said Carlin. He taxied to the runway, then took off in a very steep climb. In the passenger cabin, Gayden was laughing. He had just heard that after 6 weeks in jail with all-male company, Paul had been forced to sit through an X-rated movie, and he thought it was funny as hell. Perot popped a champagne cork and proposed a toast. "Here's to the men who said what they were going to do, then went out and did it." Ralph Boulware sipped his champagne and felt a warm glow. "That's right," he thought. "We said what we were going to do, then we went out and did it. Right." He had another reason to be happy. Next Monday was Keisha's birthday. She would be 7. Every time he had called Mary, she had said, "Get home in time for Keisha's birthday." It looked like he was going to make it. Bill began to relax at last. "Now there's nothing but a plane ride between me and America and Emily and the kids," he thought. "Now I'm safe." He had imagined himself safe before, when he reached the Hyatt in Tehran, when he crossed the border into Turkey, when he took off from Van, and when he landed in Frankfurt. He had been wrong each time, and he was wrong now.
Paul had always been crazy about airplanes, and now he took the opportunity to sit on the flight deck of the Boeing 707.
As the plane flew across the north of England, he realized that pilot John Carlin, engineer Ken Lenz, and first officer John Fosnot were having trouble. On autopilot, the plane was drifting, first to the left and then to the right. The compass had failed, rendering the inertial navigation system erratic. "What does all that mean?" Ball asked. "It means we'll have to hand-fly this thing all the way across the Atlantic," said Carlin. "But we can do it. It's kind of exhausting, that's all." A few minutes later, the plane became very cold, then very hot. Its pressurization system was failing. Carlin took the plane down low. "We can't cross the Atlantic at this height," he told Paul. "Why not?" "We don't have enough fuel. An aircraft uses much more fuel at low altitudes." "Why can't we fly high?" "Can't breathe up there." "The plane has oxygen masks." "But not enough oxygen to cross the Atlantic. No plane carries that much oxygen." Carlin and his crew fiddled with the controls for a while. Then Carlin sighed and said, "Would you get Ross up here, Paul?" "Paul, fetch Perrault," Carlin said. "Mr. Perrault, I think we ought to take this thing and land it as soon as we can." He explained again why they could not cross the Atlantic with a faulty pressure system. Paul said, "John, I'll be forever grateful to you if we don't have to land in Germany." "Don't worry," said Carlin. "We'll head for London, Heathrow." Perrault went back to tell the others. Carlin called London Air Traffic Control on the radio. It was 1 a.m, and he was told Heathrow was closed. "This is an emergency," he replied. They gave him permission to land. Paul could hardly believe it. An emergency landing after all he had been through. Ken Lenz began to dump fuel to reduce the plane below its maximum landing weight. London told Carlin there was fog over southern England, but at the moment visibility was up to 0.5 mile at Heathrow. When Ken Lenz shut off the fuel dump valves, a red light that should have gone out stayed on. "The dump chute hasn't retracted," said Lenz. "I can't believe it," said Paul. He lit a cigarette. Carlin said, "Paul, can I have a cigarette?" Paul stared at him. "You told me you quit smoking 10 years ago. Just give me a cigarette, would you?" Paul gave him a cigarette and said, "No, I'm really scared." Paul went back into the passenger cabin. The stewardesses had everyone busy stowing trays, bottles, and baggage, securing all loose objects in preparation for landing. Paul went into the bedroom. Simons was lying on the bed. He had shaved in cold water, and there were bits of stickum tape all over his face. He was fast asleep. Paul left him. He said to Jay Coburn, "Does Simons know what's going on?" "Sure does," Coburn replied. "He said he doesn't know how to fly a plane, and there's nothing he can do, so he was going to take a nap." Paul shook his head in amazement. How cool could you get? He returned to the flight deck. Carlin was as laid back as ever, his voice calm, his hand steady. But that cigarette worried Paul. A couple of minutes later, the red light went out. The dump chute had retracted. They approached Heathrow in dense cloud and began to lose height. Paul watched the altimeter. As it dropped through 600 feet, then 500, there was still nothing outside but swirling gray fog. At 300 feet, it was the same. Then, suddenly, they dropped out of the cloud, and there was the runway straight ahead, lit up like a Christmas tree. Paul breathed a sigh of relief. They touched down, and the fire engines and ambulances came screaming across the tarmac toward the plane. But it was a perfect, safe landing.
Rashid had been hearing about Ross Perot for years. Perot was the multimillionaire, the founder of EDS, the business wizard, the man who sat in Dallas and moved men such as Coburn and Scully around the world like pieces on a chessboard. It had been quite an experience for Rashid to meet Mr. Perrault and find he was just an ordinary-looking human being, rather short and surprisingly friendly. Rashid had walked into the hotel room in Istanbul, and this little guy with the big smile and the bent nose just stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, I'm Ross Perrault." And Rashid had shaken hands and said, "Hi, I'm Rashid Kazemi," just as natural as could be. Since that moment, he had felt more than ever one of the EDS team, but at Heathrow Airport, he was sharply reminded that he was not. As soon as the plane taxied to a halt, a van load of airport police, customs men, and immigration officials boarded and started asking questions. They did not like what they saw. A bunch of dirty, scruffy, smelly, unshaven men, carrying a fortune in various currencies, aboard an incredibly luxurious airplane with a Grand Cayman Islands tail number. This, they said in their British way, was highly irregular, to say the least. However, after an hour or so of questioning, they could find no evidence that the EDS men were drug smugglers, terrorists, or members of the PLO. And as holders of U.S. passports, the Americans needed no visas or other documentation to enter Britain. They were all admitted, except for Rashid.
Perrault confronted the immigration officer. "There's no reason why you should know who I am, but my name is Ross Perrault, and if you would just check me out, maybe with U.S. Customs, I believe you will conclude that you can trust me. I have too much to lose by trying to smuggle an illegal immigrant into Britain.
Now, I will assume personal responsibility for this young man. We will be out of England in 24 hours. In the morning, we will check with your counterparts at Gatwick Airport, and we will then get on the branded flight to Dallas. I'm afraid we can't do that, sir, said the official. This gentleman will have to stay with us until we put him on the plane. If he stays, I stay, said Perrault. Rashid was flabbergasted. Ross Perrault would spend the night at the airport, or perhaps in a prison cell, rather than leave Rashid behind. It was incredible. If Pat Scully had made such an offer, or Jay Coburn, Rashid would have been grateful but not surprised. But this was Ross Perrault. The immigration officer sighed. Do you know anyone in Great Britain who might vouch for you, sir? Perrault racked his brains. Who do I know in Britain, he thought. I don't think... No, wait a minute. Of course. One of Britain's great heroes had stayed with the Perrault's in Dallas a couple of times. Perrault and Margot had been guests at his home in England, a place called Broadlands. I know Earl Mountbatten of Burma, he said. I'll just have a word with my supervisor, said the officer, and he got off the plane. He was away a long time. Perrault said to Scully, As soon as we get out of here, your job is to get us all first-class seats on that branded flight to Dallas in the morning. Yes, sir, said Scully. The immigration officer came back. I can give you 24 hours, he said to Rashid. Rashid looked at Perrault. Oh, boy, he thought. What a guy to work for. They checked into the Post House Hotel near the airport, and Perrault called Merv Stauffer in Dallas. Merv, we have one person here with an Iranian passport and no U.S. visa. You know who I'm talking about. Yes, sir. He has saved American lives, and I won't have him hassled when we get to the States. Yes, sir. Call Harry McKillop. Have him fix it. Yes, sir.
Scully woke them all at 6 a.m. He had to drag Coburn out of bed. Coburn was still suffering the after-effects of Simon's stay-awake pills. Ill-tempered and exhausted, he did not care whether he caught the plane or not. Scully had organized a bus to take them to Gatwick Airport, a good two-hour journey from Heathrow. As they went out, Keen Taylor, who was struggling with a plastic bin containing some of the dozens of bottles of liquor and cartons of cigarettes he had bought at Istanbul Airport, said, Hey, do any of you guys want to help me carry this stuff? Nobody said anything. They all got on the bus. Screw you, then, said Taylor, and he gave the whole lot to the hotel doorman. On the way to Gatwick, they heard over the bus radio that China had invaded North Vietnam. Someone said, That'll be our next assignment. Sure, said Simons. We could be dropped between the two armies. No matter which way we fired, we'd be right.
At the airport, walking behind his men, Perrault noticed other people backing away, giving them room, and he suddenly realized how terrible they all looked. Most of them had not had a good wash or a shave for days, and they were dressed in a weird assortment of ill-fitting and very dirty clothes. They probably smell bad, too. Perrault asked for Braniff's passenger service officer. Braniff was a Dallas airline, and Perrault had flown with them to London several times, so most of the staff knew him. He asked the officer, Can I rent the whole of the lounge upstairs in the 747 for my party? The officer was staring at the men. Perrault knew what he was thinking. Mr. Perrault's party usually consisted of a few quiet, well-dressed businessmen, and now here he was with what looked like a crowd of garage mechanics who had been working on a particularly filthy engine. The officer said, We can't rent you the lounge because of international airline regulations, sir. But I believe if your companions go up into the lounge, the rest of our passengers won't disturb you too much. Perrault saw what he meant. As Perrault boarded, he said to a stewardess, I want these men to have anything they want on this plane. Perrault passed on, and the stewardess turned to her colleague, wide-eyed. Who the hell is he? Her colleague told her. The movie was Saturday Night Fever, but the projector would not work. Bulwer was disappointed. He had seen the movie before, and he had been looking forward to seeing it again. Instead, he sat and chewed the fat with Paul. Most of the others went up to the lounge. Once again, Simons and Coburn stretched out and went to sleep. Halfway across the Atlantic, Keen Taylor, who for the last few weeks had been carrying around anything up to $250,000 in cash and handing it out by the fistful, suddenly took it into his head to have an accounting. He spread a blanket on the floor of the lounge and started collecting money. One by one, the other members of the team came up, fished wads of banknotes out of their pockets, their boots, their hats, and their shirt sleeves, and threw the money on the floor. One or two other first-class passengers had come up to the lounge, despite the unsavory appearance of Mr. Perrault's party. But now, when this smelly, villainous-looking crew, with their beards and knit caps and dirty boots and go-to-hell coats, spread out several $100,000 on the floor and started counting it, the other passengers vanished. A few minutes later, a stewardess came up to the lounge and approached Perrault. Some of the passengers are asking whether we should inform the police about your party, she said. Would you come down and reassure them? I'd be glad to. Perrault went down to the first-class cabin and introduced himself to the passengers in the forward seats. Some of them had heard of him. He began to tell them what had happened to Paul and Bill.
As he talked, other passengers came up to listen. The cabin crew stopped work and stood nearby. Then some of the crew from the economy cabin came along. Soon there was a whole crowd. It began to dawn on Perrault that this was a story the world would want to hear.
Upstairs, the team were playing one last trick on Keene Taylor. While collecting the money, Taylor had dropped three bundles of $10,000 each, and Bill had slipped them into his own pocket. The accounting came out wrong, of course. They all sat around on the floor, Indian fashion, suppressing their laughter, while Taylor counted it all again. "How can I be $30,000 out?" Taylor said angrily. "Damn it, this is all I got. Maybe I'm not thinking clearly. What the hell's the matter with me?" At that point, Bill came up from downstairs and said, "What's the problem, Keene?" "God, we're $30,000 short, and I don't know what I did with all the rest of the money." Bill took the three stacks out of his pocket and said, "Is this what you're looking for?" They all laughed uproariously. "Give me that," Taylor said angrily. "Damn it, Gaylord, I wish I'd left you in jail." They laughed all the more.
The plane came down toward Dallas. Ross Perot sat next to Rashid and told him the names of the places they were passing over. Rashid looked out of the window at the flat brown land and the big wide roads that went straight for miles and miles. America. Joe Poche had a good feeling. He had felt this way as captain of a rugby club in Minnesota at the end of a long match when his side had won. The same feeling had come to him when he had returned from Vietnam. He had been part of a good team. He had survived. He had learned a lot. He had grown. Now all he wanted to make him perfectly happy was some clean underwear. Ron Davis was sitting next to Jay Coburn. "Hey, Jay, what do we do for a living now?" Coburn smiled. "I don't know." It would be strange, Davis thought, to sit behind a desk again. He was not sure he liked the idea. He suddenly remembered that Marva was now 3 months pregnant. It would be starting to show. He wondered how she would look with a bulging tummy. "I know what I need," he thought. "I need a Coke in the can from a machine in a gas station and a Kentucky Fried Chicken." Pat Scully was thinking, no more orange cabs. Scully was sitting next to Jim Schwabach. They were together again, the short but deadly duo, having fired not a single shot at anyone during the whole adventure. They'd been talking about what EDS could learn from the rescue. The company had projects in other Middle Eastern countries and was pushing into the Far East. Should there perhaps be a permanent rescue team, a group of troubleshooters trained and fit and armed and willing to do covert operations in faraway countries? No, they decided. This had been a unique situation. Scully realized he did not want to spend any more time in primitive countries. In Tehran, he had hated the morning trial of squeezing into an orange cab with two or three grumpy people, Persian music blaring from the car radio, and the inevitable quarrel with the driver over the fare. "Wherever I work next," he thought, "whatever I do, I'm going to ride to the office by myself in my own car, a big fat American automobile with air conditioning and soft music. And when I go to the bathroom, instead of squatting over a hole in the damn floor, there will be a clean, white American toilet." As the plane touched down, Perrault said to him, "Pat, you'll be last out. I want you to make sure everyone gets through the formalities and deal with any problems." "Sure." The plane taxied to a halt. The door was opened, and a woman came aboard. "Where is the man?" she said. "Here," said Perrault, pointing to Rashid. Rashid was first off the plane. Perrault thought, Merv Stauffer has all that taken care of. The others disembarked and went through customs. On the other side, the first person Coburn saw was stocky, bespectacled Merv Stauffer, grinning from ear to ear. Coburn put his arms around Stauffer and hugged him. Stauffer reached into his pocket and pulled out Coburn's wedding ring. Coburn was touched. He had left the ring with Stauffer for safekeeping. Since then, Stauffer had been the linchpin of the whole operation, sitting in Dallas with a phone to his ear making everything happen. Coburn had talked to him almost every day, relaying Simons's orders and demands, receiving information and advice. He knew better than anyone how important Stauffer had been, how they had all just relied on him to do whatever had to be done. Yet with all that happening, Stauffer had remembered the wedding band.
Coburn slipped it on. He had done a lot of hard thinking about his marriage during the empty hours in Tehran, but now all that went out of his mind and he looked forward to seeing Liz. Merv told him to walk out of the airport and get on a bus that was waiting outside. Coburn followed directions. On the bus he saw Margot Perrault. He smiled and shook hands. Then suddenly the air was filled with screams of joy, and four wildly excited children threw themselves at him. Kim, Christy, Scott, and Kelly. Coburn laughed out loud and tried to hug them all at the same time. Liz was standing behind the kids. Gently, Coburn disentangled himself, his eyes filled with tears. He put his arms around his wife, and he could not speak. When Keene Taylor got on the bus, his wife did not recognize him. Her normally elegant husband was wearing a filthy orange ski jacket and a knitted cap. He had not shaved for a week, and he had lost 15 pounds. He He stood in front of her for several seconds until Liz Coburn said, "Mary, aren't you going to say hello to Keene?" Then his children, Mike and Dawn, grabbed him. Today was Taylor's birthday. He was 41. It was the happiest birthday of his life. John Howell saw his wife, Angela, sitting at the front of the bus behind the driver with Michael, 11 months, on her lap. The baby was wearing blue jeans and a striped rugby shirt. Howell picked him up and said, "Hi, Michael. Do you remember your daddy?" He sat next to Angie and put his arms around her. It was kind of awkward on the bus seat, and Howell was normally too shy for public displays of affection, but he kept right on hugging her because it felt so good. Ralph Bulwer was met by Mary and the girls, Stacy and Keisha. He picked Keisha up and said, "Happy birthday." Everything was as it should be, he thought, as he embraced them. He had done what he was supposed to do, and the family was here where they were supposed to be. He felt as though he had proved something, if only to himself. All those years in the Air Force, tinkering with instrumentation or sitting in a plane watching bombs drop, he had never felt his courage was being tested. His relations had medals for ground fighting, but he had always had the uncomfortable feeling that he had an easy role, like the guy in the war movies who slops out the food at breakfast time before the real soldiers go off to fight. He had always wondered whether he had the right stuff. Now he thought about Turkey and getting stuck in Adana, and driving through the blizzard in that damn 64 Chevy, and changing the wheel in Blood Alley with the sons of Mr. Fisher's cousin. And he thought about Perot's toast to the men who said what they were going to do, then went out and did it. And he knew the answer. Oh, yes, he had the right stuff. Paul's daughters, Karen and Anne-Marie, were wearing matching plaid skirts. Anne-Marie, the littlest, got to him first, and he swept her up in his arms and squeezed her tight. Karen was too big to be picked up, but he hugged her just as hard. Behind them was Ruthie, his biggest little girl, all dressed in shades of honey and cream. He kissed her long and hard, then looked at her, smiling. He could not have stopped smiling if he had wanted to. He felt very mellow inside. It was the best feeling he had ever known. Emily was looking at Bill as if she did not believe he was really there. "Gosh," she said lamely, "it's good to see you again, sweetie." The bus went rather quiet as he kissed her. Rachel Schwabach began to cry. Bill kissed the girls, Vicky, Jackie, and Jenny. Then he looked at his son. Chris was very grown up in a blue suit he had been given for Christmas. Bill had seen that suit before. He remembered a photograph of Chris standing in front of the Christmas tree in his new suit. That photograph had been above Bill's bunk in a prison cell long ago and far away. Emily kept touching him to make sure he was really there. "You look marvelous," she said. Bill knew he looked absolutely terrible. He said, "I love you." Ross Perot got on the bus and said, "Is everybody here?" "Not my dad," said a plaintive small voice. It was Sean Scully. "Don't worry," said Perot. "He'll be right out. He's our straight man."
Pat Scully had been stopped by a customs agent and asked to open his suitcase. He was carrying all the money, and of course the agent had seen it. Several more agents were summoned, and Scully was taken into an office to be interrogated. The agents got out some forms. Scully began to explain, but they did not want to listen. They only wanted to fill out the form. "Is the money yours?" "No, it belongs to EDS. "Did you have it when you left the States?" "Most of it." "When and how did you leave the States?" "A week ago on a private 707. "Where did you go?" "To Istanbul and then to the Iranian border." Another man came into the office and said, "Are you Mr. Scully?" "Yes." "I'm terribly sorry you've been troubled like this. Mr. Perot is waiting for you outside." He turned to the agents. "You can tear up those forms." Scully smiled and left. He was not in the Middle East anymore. This was Dallas, where Perot was Perot. Scully got on the bus and saw Mary, Sean, and Jennifer. He hugged and kissed them all, then said, "What's happening?" "There's a little reception for you," said Mary. The bus started to move, but it did not go far. It stopped again, a few yards away at a different gate, and they were all ushered back into the airport and led to a door marked Concord Room. As they walked in, 1,000 people rose to their feet, cheering and clapping. Someone had put up a huge banner reading, "John Howell, Number One Daddy."
Jay Coburn was overwhelmed by the size of the crowd and their reaction. What a good idea the buses had been, to give the men a chance to greet their families in private before coming in here. Who had arranged that? Stouffer, of course. As he walked through the room toward the front, people in the crowd reached over to shake his hand, saying, "Good to see you. Welcome back." He smiled and shook hands. There was David Bean. There was Dick Morrison. The faces blurred, and the words melted into one big, warm hello. When Paul and Bill walked in with their wives and children, The cheering rose to a roar. Ross Perot, standing at the front, felt tears come to his eyes. He was more tired than he had ever been in his life, but immensely satisfied. He thought of all the luck and all the coincidences that had made the rescue possible, the fact that he knew Simons, that Simons had been willing to go, that EDS had hired Vietnam veterans, that they had been willing to go, that the 7th floor knew how to get things achieved around the world because of their experience with the POW campaign, that TJ had been able to rent a plane, that the mob had stormed the Gasser prison. And he thought of all the things that might have gone wrong. He recalled the proverb, "Success has 1,000 fathers, but failure is an orphan." In a few minutes, he would stand up and tell these people a little of what had happened and how Paul and Bill were brought home. But it would be hard to put into words the risks that had been taken, the awful cost if the thing had gone badly and ended in the criminal courts, or worse. He remembered the day he left Tehran and how he had superstitiously thought of his luck as sand running through an hourglass. Suddenly he saw the hourglass again, and all the sand had run out. He grinned to himself, picked up the imaginary glass, and turned it upside down.
Simons bent down and spoke in Perot's ear. "Remember you offered to pay me." Perot would never forget it. When Simons gave you that icy look, you froze. "I sure do." "See this?" said Simons, inclining his head. Paul was walking toward them, carrying Anne-Marie in his arms through the crowd of cheering friends. "I see it," said Perot. Simons said, "I just got paid." He drew in his cigar.
At last the room quieted down, and Perot began to speak. He called Rashid over and put his arm around the young man's shoulders. "I want you to meet a key member of the rescue team," he said to the crowd. "As Colonel Simons said, Rashid only weighs 140 pounds, but he has 500 pounds of courage." They all laughed and clapped again. Rashid looked around. Many times he thought about going to America, but in his wildest dreams he had never imagined that his welcome would be like this.
Perot began to tell the story. Listening, Paul felt oddly humble. He was not a hero. The others were the heroes. He was privileged. He belonged with just about the finest bunch of people in the whole world. Bill looked around the crowd and saw Ron Sperberg, a good friend and a colleague for years. Sperberg was wearing a great big cowboy hat. "We're back in Texas," Bill thought. "This is the heartland of the USA, the safest place in the world. They can't reach us here. This time, the nightmare is really over. We're back. We're safe. We're home."
Epilogue. Jay and Liz Coburn were divorced. Christy, the second daughter, the emotional one, chose to live with her father.
Coburn was made manager of human resources for EDS Federal. In September 1982, he and Ross Perot Jr. became the first men to fly around the world in a helicopter. The aircraft they used is now the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. It is called Spirit of Texas.
Paul became comptroller of EDS, and Bill became Medicaid marketing director in the healthcare division. Joe Poche, Pat Scully, Jim Schwabach, Ron Davis, and Rashid all continued to work for EDS in various parts of the world.
Davis's wife, Marva, gave birth to a boy, Benjamin, on July 18, 1979.
Keane Taylor was made country manager for EDS in the Netherlands, where he was joined by Glenn Jackson. Gayden continued to be head of EDS World, and therefore Taylor's boss.
John Howell was made a full partner in Tom Luce's law firm, Hughes and Hill.
Angela Howell had another baby, Sarah, on June 19, 1980.
Rich Gallagher left EDS on July 1, 1979. An Easterner, he had never quite felt one of the boys at EDS. Lloyd Briggs and Paul Buca, two more Easterners, left around the same time.
Ralph Bulware also parted company with EDS.
Lulu May Perot, Ross Perot's mother, died on April 3, 1979. Ross Perot Jr. graduated from college and went to work for his father in the fall of 1981. A year later, Nancy Perot did the same.
Perot himself just went on making more and more money. His real estate appreciated. His oil company found wells, and EDS won more and bigger contracts. EDS shares, priced around $18 apiece when Paul and Bill were arrested, were worth six times that 4 years later.
Colonel Simons died on May 21, 1979, after a series of heart attacks. In the last few weeks of his life, his constant companion was Anita Melton, the zany stewardess from the Boeing 707. They had an odd, tragic relationship. They never became lovers in the physical sense, but they were in love. They lived together in the guest cottage at Perot's Dallas house. She taught him to cook, and he started her jogging, timing her with a stopwatch. They held hands a lot. After Simons died, his son Harry and Harry's wife Sean had a baby boy. They named him Arthur Simons, Jr.
On November 4, 1979, the U.S. Embassy in Tehran was once again overrun by militant Iranians. This time, they took hostages. 52 Americans were held prisoner for more than a year. A rescue mission mounted by President Carter came to an ignominious end in the deserts of central Iran.
But then, Carter did not have the help of Bull Simons.
Appendix. In the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas, Dallas Division. Electronic Data Systems Corporation, Iran, versus Social Security Organization of the Government of Iran, the Ministry of Health and Welfare of the Government of Iran, the Government of Iran. Number CA37918F. Extracts from the Findings of Fact. Neither EDSCI nor anyone on its behalf procured the contract unlawfully. No evidence showed bribery of any official or employee of defendants in order to secure the contract, nor did the evidence suggest the existence of fraud or public corruption in the procurement of the contract. The price of the contract was not exorbitant. Rather, the evidence showed that the price was reasonable and in accordance with amounts charged by EDS to others for similar services. The price did not compare unfavorably with amounts charged by others in the healthcare industry for similar services. The failure by SSO and the Ministry to provide written notice of non-acceptance of unpaid invoices was inexcusable, and therefore constituted a breach of contract. The assignment of Dr. Tolia T. to SSO as Deputy Managing Director did not affect such an excuse. I do not find evidence that Dr. Tolia T.'s services influenced the process of approval for invoices. Nor do I find evidence that Dr. Tolia T. functioned improperly in his review of performance under the contract. Rather, the evidence showed that the Ministry and SSO had full and continuous opportunity to monitor EDSCI's performance. Moreover, I do not find credible evidence of trickery or that EDSCI conspired with anyone to gain wrongful approval for payment of its invoices, or to deny the defendants fair opportunity for their evaluation of EDSCI's performance under the contract. EDSCI did not materially breach its performance obligations under the contract. Rather, EDSCI substantially performed in accordance with the description and timing of its duties for each applicable phase up until January 16, 1978, the date of termination of the contract. Recovery under the contract is not barred by defendants' claims, unsupported by the evidence that EDSCI procured the contract by fraud, bribery, or public corruption. Specifically, the evidence did not demonstrate that EDS's relationship with the Mavi Group was illegal. EDSCI's execution of and performance under the contract violated no Iranian law. Plaintiff introduced a plethora of evidence showing the fact and result of its services. Testimony from those who managed and implemented the data processing systems, photographic evidence illustrating aspects of the data preparation's functions developed, as well as reports jointly prepared by EDSCI and the Ministry of benefits being realized from the contract. Credible evidence failed to directly rebut this showing. Extract from the final judgment. It is ordered, adjudged, and decreed that plaintiff, Electronic Data Systems Corporation, Iran, have and recover of defendants, the Government of Iran, the Social Security Organization of the Government of Iran, and the Ministry of Health and Welfare of the Government of Iran, jointly and severally, the sum of $15,177,404, plus $2,812,251 as pre-judgment interest, plus $1,079,875 as attorney's fees, plus interest on all such sums at the rate of 9% per annum from the date hereof, plus all costs of suit herein.
Author's acknowledgments. Many people helped me by talking to me for hours on end, by replying to my letters, and by reading and correcting drafts of the book. For their patience, frankness, and willing cooperation, I thank especially the following. Paul and Ruthie Chiapperoni, Bill and Emily Gaylord, Jay and Liz Coburn, Joe Pochet, Pat and Mary Scully, Ralph and Mary Bulware, Jim Schwabach, Ron Davis, Glenn Jackson, Bill Gaydon, Keen Taylor, Rich and Kathy Gallagher, Paul Buca, Lloyd Briggs, Bob Young, John Howell, Rashid, Tony Divaranchuk, Kathy Marcatos, T.J. Marcus, Tom Walter, Tom Luce, Merv Stoffer, for whom nothing is too much trouble, Margot Perreault, Betty Perreault, John Carlin, Anita Melton, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Ramsey Clark, Bob Strauss, William Sullivan, Charles Nass, Lou Goltz, Henry Precht, John Stemple, Dr. Manocher Razmara, Stanley Simons, Bruce Simons, Harry Simons, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Crone at the Pentagon, Major Dick Meadows, Major General Robert McKinnon, Dr. Walter Stewart, Dr. Harold Kimmerling. As usual, I was helped by two indefatigable researchers, Dan Starr in New York and Karen Meyer in London. I was also helped by the remarkable switchboard staff at EDS headquarters in Dallas. More than 100 hours of taped interviews were transcribed, mainly by Sally Walther, Claire Woodward, Linda Huff, Cheryl Hibbets, and Becky DeLuna. Finally, I thank Ross Perreault, without whose astonishing energy and determination, not only this book, but the adventure that is its subject, would have been impossible.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of On Wings of Eagles by Ken Follett.